Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Khan Slobochikov. He is a professor of biology at Northern Arizona University, and he's co-author of the new book, Prairie Dogs, Communication and Community in an Animal Society. And he will be in Santa Fe this Sunday, the 10th of October, from 5 until 6:30 at the Inn and Spa at Loretto. And it's a talk in the Meet the Authors series, sponsored by Garcia Street Books. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So let's talk, first of all, about the numbers of prairie dogs that we have here in North America. They were a very successful species until about the turn of the last century, into the last century. What were their numbers 100, 110 years ago, and what are they now?
Well, nobody really knows exactly what their numbers were, but there were probably around 5 billion prairie dogs at that time, at the turn of the century. Now, we are down to about 2% of what we had before. So just imagine, for example, the plaza at Santa Fe filled with 100 people, and you pluck 98 out of them, and you're left with only two people. That's the situation with prairie dogs today.
We'll get back to the whole question of endangered species in a little bit, but I wanted to give you some time to really talk about them as animals. What do they eat? Who are their predators? Tell us about these little creatures.
Sure. These animals are rodents. They're about foot long. They weigh about roughly 1 to 2 pounds. They are small furry creatures with short tails. And everybody thinks that as rodents, they breed all the time the way that rats do. But they don't. They actually reproduce only once a year. And the typical female has a litter of between 4 to 5 pups, of which typically 2 die over the winter. So typically in a prairie dog town, they reproduce only once a year, and each female produces perhaps only enough to replace the ones who die off. So they're not breeding like rats the way that some people say. They do eat plants. They like to eat grass. They like to eat other plants as well. And people often say that because they eat grass, they compete with cows. But the evidence on this really is not in at this point. There have been several studies which have looked at competition between prairie dogs and cows. And some of the studies have found that prairie dogs have no effect on the weight of cows if they are in the same paddock together. Other studies have shown that there is a very small effect of prairie dogs on the weight of cows if they're in the same paddock together. But what we do know is that we used to have 5 billion prairie dogs with many, many bison, American buffalo, living together in the same plains areas, eating the same vegetation. And there was no problem of competition. They both ate grass, and everybody coexisted very happily. Their predators are a variety of animals. Coyotes eat them, ferruginous hawks eat them, black-footed ferrets used to eat them, and now because the prairie dog numbers have dwindled so much, black-footed ferrets are an extremely endangered species, which the Fish and Wildlife Service is trying to reintroduce back into the wild through concerted breeding programs. There's a bunch of different predators that eat them, but because prairie dogs have such a sophisticated language of alarm calls, the predators really aren't that successful because the prairie dogs are able to warn each other about the approaching predator.
What are their burrows like? When you see little prairie dog villages, they have these holes, and underneath the ground, they're quite elaborate.
Yes, they're quite elaborate. Typically, within a prairie dog territory, which might have anywhere between a single prairie dog and perhaps 15 or 20 prairie dogs living on that territory, there's a fairly elaborate burrow system, usually with maybe anywhere between 1 to 5 or 6 burrow openings into the surface And then each burrow goes down somewhere between 3 and 5 feet and can run for maybe 20 or 30 feet horizontally under the ground surface. Within that, they have sleeping chambers. They have chambers where they go to the bathroom. They have chambers which are used as turning bays when one prairie dog is going up out of the burrow and another prairie dog is coming down at the same time. One of them backs up into one of these turning bays so that the other can get by. It's a very elaborate kind of system that they have. One of the interesting things about the burrows, too, is that the prairie dogs that are in Santa Fe are the white-tailed prairie dog group, and the white-tailed prairie dogs hibernate over winter. So what the prairie dogs do is they plug up their burrow openings when winter comes, and they curl up and go to sleep inside those burrows and spend the entire winter asleep, where the temperature is fairly uniform, even though outside the winds could be howling and the snow could be falling and the temperatures really drop. Down below in the ground, the temperature is quite uniform for them.
One thing that's fascinating about that is that when they hibernate, first of all, they don't sleep through the winter. They get up, once a week or something like that, but when they're asleep, when they're in that hibernating position, all curled up, they lower their body temperature extremely.
Yes, and that's really amazing when they do that. They lower their body temperature down to roughly about what the ambient temperature is in the burrows. They curl up, and the most amazing thing is that their muscles get really rigid so that you can't uncurl them. I've held sleeping prairie dogs, hibernating sleeping prairie dogs in my hand, and tried to pull gently on them. They curl up into kind of a C-shaped form when they're asleep. And I pulled gently on them, and the muscles have locked so hard that I felt that if I pulled just a little bit harder, I'd break the prairie dog in two.
Meanwhile, then they get up every few days, and what do? Walk around? Do they eat?
Well, nobody really knows what they do. They run around, and maybe they eat. Typically, people say that prairie dogs don't store any food underground, but we found in times when a badger has dug up some of our prairie dog study colony where we've been feeding them sunflower seeds, we found that there are huge hordes of sunflower seeds that they've taken down below. And they also bring hay down into their burrows to line their burrows, make beds softer to sleep on. And probably if they run out of food and they get hungry, they can probably munch on some of this hay because it is, after all, dried plants.
We're talking to Khan Slobochikov about prairie dogs. So their survival advantages, as anybody who's watched a prairie dog can see, it's not about speed or outrunning predators. How do they protect themselves?
They have several different strategies. One of their best strategies is to run to their burrows and escape into their burrows because coyotes can't follow them into the burrows. Hawks can't catch them once they go into the burrows. Snakes can get into the burrows, but probably most rattlesnakes or gopher snakes probably can't eat a big prairie dog, an adult prairie dog, but they could probably eat the baby prairie dogs. And badgers will dig up the entire burrow system, and often they'll do this in the winter when prairie dogs are sleeping. So the badger will go in, excavate the entire burrow system, and munch on the prairie dogs, kind of like eating cold cuts.
Meanwhile, they have this incredible language, and most of what we know about their language is their alarm or warning sounds. They can say things, and I think it's important that you point out in this book, in your book, Prairie Dogs, that you really don't have to anthropomorphize them to see the similarities between them and us, and I think their sophisticated language is really a remarkable thing to talk about.
Yes, actually, at this point, their sophisticated language is the most sophisticated animal language that's been decoded so far. Now, this is not to say that other animals don't probably have more sophisticated languages, like we think that whales and dolphins have a sophisticated language. The problem is decoding it, because whales and dolphins make lots and lots of sounds, but the sounds are underwater where you can't really see what the context is of what's going on. You don't really see what the dolphin is making sounds about or the whale is making sounds about, so it's hard to decode this kind of thing. It's kind of like somebody listening in on this conversation who has no clue what English is all about and who even doesn't have a clue that we humans have a language. It's really hard for them to get any traction in figuring out how to decode a language or even if there is a language. But with the prairie dogs, we've been very fortunate in that we found the Rosetta Stone for decoding the language. And that is, their alarm calls are given in response to predators that come through hunting for the prairie dogs in the colony. And so when a predator appears, the prairie dogs give a series of chirps, which is an alarm call. And for us, we can see what's happening. We can videotape the predator. We can videotape the responses of the prairie dogs. We can record on audio the alarm calls of the prairie dogs. We can then analyze the alarm calls on a computer. And then we can play back the alarm calls when no predator is there and see if the prairie dogs have exactly the same escape responses as when the predator is present. And we've done that, and they do. They have exactly the same escape responses when we play back a call for a coyote as when the coyote is present and the prairie dogs are calling for the coyote. So we know that the alarm calls contain meaningful information. And it turns out that there's a lot of information. Those alarm calls contain information about the species of predator. We know that they have an alarm call for a coyote. They have an alarm call for a human. They have another one for a domestic dog. They have another one for a red-tailed hawk. They have another one for a badger. And they also contain information about the size and shape of the predator, the color, the general speed of travel of the predator, which is phenomenal. This is like in a human language, there are nouns such as coyote, badger, human. There are adjectives like blue, yellow, big, small. There are verbs, moving fast, moving slow. And we've also found through fairly sophisticated computer analysis that one of my computer science colleagues and I have worked on, that they have another element that we find in human languages, which so far has never been found in any other animal language. And that is that they have meaningful units of sound called phonemes in human linguistics, which they can recombine into larger units of meaning, such as coyote or hawk. So they have a lot of the same elements of human language.
So you're basically saying they have words.
They have words, absolutely.
I find it fascinating that they can differentiate between, for example, coyotes and domestic dogs. They can basically say, look out for that big guy running in the blue shirt.
Right.
And where I live, there's a park that until very recently had a prairie dog colony in it, and I noticed, I mean, I haven't done what you guys have done, which is recorded it and compared the waveforms and all that kind of thing. I just, going out there every day to walk dogs, I swear there was a difference between how they sounded and behaved when I went out there with the geriatric poodle and with the young predatory terriers. There was a different response.
Sure, absolutely. And they can tell the differences between a geriatric poodle and a predatory terrier. And what's more, they can actually tailor their description to say, this is maybe a small, slow-moving poodle versus this is a small, fast-running dog. And one of the things that's really fascinating about the alarm calls is that the alarm calls come through as a series of chirps. So it sounds sort of like cheep, cheep, cheep. But each one of those chirps or cheeps is the equivalent of a sentence. It would be like in a short cheep, we would say, tall, thin, human, wearing blue, moving slowly. And that's just simply amazing to me that an animal can pack that much information into such a short burst of sound. Each one of these things is about a tenth of a second long. So you hear it as cheep, and that's it.
Well, it's amazing to me that you guys figured it out, too.
I think we were lucky, actually, because of this ability to see the context of what was going on. And we kind of figured it out because early on when I started studying prairie dogs, I noticed that the prairie dogs had alarm calls. And this was nothing new. Everybody knew that prairie dogs had alarm calls. And at the time, I was more interested in their social behavior. And they have an elaborate social behavior, which is kind of equivalent to human social behavior in medieval villages. But I noticed that they had these alarm calls, and at the time, other people were saying that ground squirrels, related species to prairie dogs, had two types of alarm calls. They had one for aerial predators, such as hawks, and one for terrestrial predators, such as coyotes. I thought it would really be interesting to see if prairie dogs had the same thing. So I went out with some of my students. We recorded the calls to aerial predators and to terrestrial predators and found that, sure enough, there was a difference. But within each one of these categories, there was a lot of variation. And I couldn't really figure out why is there so much variation. Could be because of individual variation, but that didn't really seem to fit. So I had a sudden insight that what if they are describing the species of predator? So we tried this out with using a tame human and a tame dog and walked them through the colony. And sure enough, there was a difference within that terrestrial category. There was a difference for human call versus dog call. So we tried a bunch of different humans to see how much variation there was. And there still was a lot of variation within the human call. And then I had another sudden insight that what if they're describing each individual human?
Right.
And so we tried some fairly elaborate experiments where we dressed humans in different colored T-shirts and walked them out through the colony. These humans differed in size and shape. And sure enough, the prairie dogs could describe each individual human. But when we dressed the humans in a big, floppy, white lab coat that obscured most of the physical features of the humans, the prairie dogs couldn't tell the humans apart, except for one person who was extremely short and walked in a very aggressive style. They could always tell her apart.
Right, right.
But the others, they would get confused.
Well, I find it fascinating also that when they're confronted with new things they've never seen before, they adapt their linguistic structure to actually come up with essentially new words for those new things.
Right, and that's a feature of human languages, that we can manufacture new words. We can say that I've gone and Xeroxed these papers, for example, which 50 years ago nobody would know what anybody was talking about. So that's a feature of human languages, which, again, nobody expected to find in an animal language. And yet, they can describe, for example, we've done some experiments where we had a black oval that we ran on a wire across the prairie dog colony, and they all consistently had a distinct word for black oval, which was different from a silhouette of a coyote that we ran in the same way across the colony and was different from a silhouette of a skunk. We've also tried them with geometric shapes such as squares and circles and triangles, and they have words for triangle. They have another word for circle. They have a hard time telling the difference between a circle and a square, though, if they're roughly about the same size.
When you think about that, circles and squares being abstract shapes really don't have that much relationship to their evolutionary survival, and the fact that they can create words for them in the first place, objects that are really not useful to their daily lives, is really something.
Yeah, and it's amazing, and we have no idea how they go about doing it. It's like they have a vocabulary in their brain, and they just pull out little descriptive words out of this vocabulary in their brain and recombine it into a sentence.
Now, do we know anything about their language besides the warnings? Because, I mean, they probably have some, I don't know, language down in their burrows, you know, maybe family dinner time talk or something like that. But I guess you haven't really put microphones into the burrows so much as you have in their outside life.
Well, we have actually tried to look at that. And they have what we call social chatter, which is one form of social chatter is that one prairie dog might be feeding someplace and then lift up its head and go chitter, chatter, chitter, 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 which is different from the alarm call, chee, 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 chee. So another prairie dog somewhere across the colony lifts up its head and goes chatter, chitter, chitter. Now we can record this. We can show that within this string of chatters and chitters, there are different acoustic elements. We can even show that there's a syntax of how these acoustic elements show up. Certain ones appear more often at the beginning of the chatter. Others appear more often at the end of the chatter. Others appear more often in the middle. But the problem is, without a context, how do we decode it?
Exactly.
It would be, again, like listening in on this conversation. So some of the ones that appear at the beginning might be like, hi, I'm talking to everybody. And at the end might be something like, okay, I'm checking out here, but we don't know. You know,
do we know, for example, whether different groups of the same species and different species of prairie dog can understand each other?
Well, we know, I think, pretty well that different species can't understand each other. Although we haven't done this experiment, one of my students traveled around to the range of all of the different species, all of the five different species of prairie dogs, and she walked out into prairie dog colonies wearing both a yellow shirt and a green shirt at different times and recorded their vocalization. And when you look at the acoustic pattern of the vocalizations, the vocalizations for, say, Gunnison's, which you have in Santa Fe and which I study in Flagstaff, are very different from the vocalizations for yellow shirt of blacktails, which are farther south in New Mexico, for example.
But, I mean, do all the Gunnisons, you know, the ones in Arizona and the ones in New Mexico, do they speak the same language?
They speak the same language, but we found that they have dialects. So that the farther away you get from a place, the more inflected, in a way, the pronunciation is. It would be sort of like saying dog in California and maybe dog in Texas.
Right, right. Now, there's a lot of prairie dog relocation but some prairie dog relocation that goes on. Is their language affected in any way when they're relocated, do you know?
Well, we don't really know what the answer to that question is. We do know that, for example, the word for human in Flagstaff is the same as the word for human in Santa Fe, except that it has this slight dialectic difference. But how much that makes a difference, we don't really know. That's one of the things that we still need to do, is go out and test this. The basic way that we could test this would be to go out with loudspeakers and say, around Santa Fe, we could play back a warning call for a coyote that we recorded in Flagstaff and see how long it takes the prairie dogs to figure it out and respond.
Now, what is their family structure like?
Their family structure is that they live in territories. So there is a social unit that occupies a territory. So kind of think like a prairie dog town is like a subdivision. And within each subdivision, there may be houses that occupy like 1 acre. It's much smaller scale on prairie dogs, but think of it as a subdivision with 1 acre houses. And inside each one of these houses might live anywhere from 1 to 15 or so prairie dogs. So on a prairie dog scale, each one of these territories is roughly about 150 feet in diameter. So within this territory, we have usually at least one male adult, usually at least one female adult, and the female's young. Now, in the past, we used to think that this was a family group, that the male and female mated with each other, and they had young, and the young were all related to the male and obviously related to the female. But now, with recent DNA evidence that one of my former students and I have looked at, we find that that's not so. What we find is that each female on a territory, when she becomes receptive to mating, and that only occurs on one day of the year for about 5 hours. That's all the time that she has to mate for that year. If she misses that time, forget it. So during that one period of time, she mates with the resident male or males on the territory. But she also goes around and tries to mate with as many males on other territories as she can. And it's just like cats, which have multiple paternity. Prairie dogs have multiple paternity, so if she has four pups that are born, perhaps only one of those pups might have been sired by the resident male on the territory, and three of those pups might have been sired by other males on other territories. But once she mates, then she comes back to the territory, and then she and the male and other prairie dogs who live there all collectively defend the boundaries of their territory against other prairie dogs. So we go back to the subdivision analogy, where now everybody living in a house on 1 acre defends the boundaries of their property against their neighbors. So when the neighbors cross into their property, they say, hey, get out of here.
Why are they so territorial?
I wish we knew, but we have only guesses. And here are the guesses. One guess is that each territory contains food that the prairie dogs eat. It has the grass that they eat. It has the various other plants that they eat. And that food probably is enough for the prairie dogs on the territory to put on enough fat to make it through the winter. So if other prairie dogs come in there and eat this food, the prairie dogs living on the territory may not be able to make it through the winter because they really depend on putting on enough fat to make it through hibernation. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is that burrows are extremely expensive to dig energetically because they're digging through soil that often is like concrete. And so they don't want to give up their burrows that they've laboriously excavated to other animals that haven't put in the effort. And
right,
so they keep them out. Again, you know, it's very similar to human society.
Right,
we don't want to give up our resources to somebody who hasn't put in the effort.
I find it fascinating that they have, I mean, I suppose if you look closely enough, you'd find this in almost any animal, but they have real differences in personalities. And there's one example that shows both their personal differences and their intelligence. In one of the places that you did your field work, there was a female. Now, you would catch the prairie dogs in order to mark them with the numbers so that you could tell which was which. And there was this one female prairie dog who liked the sunflower seeds in your traps. So wherever your traps were, she would come and get trapped, eat the seeds. She got quite fat because she knew that you weren't going to hurt her, and she wanted the snack.
Absolutely. We were very frustrated with her because we'd caught her many times, and she was well-marked, and she kept showing up in the traps. As soon as we would open up the traps, she would run over there. She'd even push other prairie dogs out of the way to get into the trap. And then once she was in there, she would stuff her mouth full of seeds as quickly as she could because she knew that we would come very soon to let her out.
And that you weren't going to hurt her. I mean,
yes, and that's the amazing thing, that when we work with these animals, that we take them out of the trap and we hold them and use hair dye to paint letters and numbers on them so that we can tell who the individual prairie dogs are. And generally speaking, all of my crew like prairie dogs, and they all like animals. And so they're very gentle with the prairie dogs. Now, you can't be really gentle. You have to hold on to them tight because they are very strong. But within that constraint, our crew is very gentle with them, and just about all of the prairie dogs, as soon as we start holding them, they just relax and just sort of drift off. You can see the eyes kind of close and their legs get sort of limp, and they just drift off while we're painting the letters and numbers on them. And then we let them go and they run away. But we had one person who worked for me for a couple of years who, oddly enough, would hunt prairie dogs in his spare time. He'd shoot them. And I never could figure this out, but whenever he was holding prairie dogs, they were always trying to bite him. He was the only one that they actually tried to bite.
That's fascinating. Now, they have a greeting, prairie dogs, that looks like a kiss. They greet each other, and they basically touch their mouths and tongues together when they greet. It looks, again, I mean, you don't want to anthropomorphize them, but we don't know really for sure why they do it. Is it possible that they are doing what we do when we greet each other with a hug and a kiss?
Well, it's certainly possible. I'm not really sure that we know what we do when we greet each other with a kiss, except that it feels good. And maybe that's the reason that prairie dogs do it. There have been several theories for why they do this. And one theory is that this is a way of individually recognizing each other inside the burrows, which are dark, so they can't see who's running into them in the burrow. They could probably smell each other, but they can also taste each other on the tongues. And another theory is that this is a way for the prairie dogs to share with each other the kinds of foods that they've been eating on the territory. So maybe a new kind of flower comes popping up, and one of the prairie dogs munches on it, and it tastes really good. And the next time that he or she kisses another prairie dog, the other prairie dog says, "Wow, this is really good, and I'll look for something like this to eat." But those are only hypotheses. And even though we have tried to test for this and other people have tried to test for this, we've never really come up with any definitive reason for why they do it. And maybe they do it because it just simply feels good.
We're talking to Kon Slobochikov. He is a professor of biology at Northern Arizona University and author of the book Prairie Dogs. So let's really talk now about prairie dog conservation and their ecosystems. They're an amazing illustration of the complexity of ecosystems and ecosystem management, because they have great benefit to the grassland, which is their native habitat, to the porosity of the soil. They make the soil more porous and more able to absorb groundwater. They affect plants. They are really very much a part of these systems, which change radically when they are eradicated, which they've been in so many places.
Yes, and that's what is also amazing to me, is that one would think, and you've listed so many benefits that prairie dogs have for the ecosystem. They are considered to be a keystone species, which is a species that has a disproportionate effect on all the other species in the ecosystem. Because of their burrows, they provide lots of shelter to a variety of animals. As you say, they provide porosity for water to percolate into the water table. They also, by modifying the habitat, they provide food for a variety of animals. Buffalo, for example, bison, preferentially like to graze around the edges of prairie dog towns. Pronghorn antelope preferentially like to graze in the middle of prairie dog towns, because as the prairie dogs clip the vegetation resprouts, and it's nice and tender and nutritious and doesn't have a variety of toxins in it. And so animals like large herbivores can digest this very well. Burrowing owls use the burrows of prairie dogs for their nests. So there's a tremendous number of benefits, and yet people go around poisoning prairie dogs. And that's part of the reason why we have less than 2% of the prairie dogs left that we had 100 years ago, is because the federal government, state governments, county governments have in the past, and some continue to do so, have poisoning campaigns to get rid of prairie dogs.
And why is that?
Well, I think that the perception is that prairie dogs compete with cows for grass. And as I mentioned earlier, there's no really good evidence that prairie dogs seriously diminish the economic value of cows. One of the latest papers showed that they might diminish the value of cows by about 5% in terms of weight gain, which really we're talking about a few tens of dollars, not very much money as these things go. But the perception is that prairie dogs compete with cows for grass, and we have the old Western mentality that what isn't good for cows isn't good for people, and so we have to get rid of it. This is why we had all of these predator eradication programs. This is why the wolf disappeared. This is why bears disappeared. And prairie dogs fall into the same category. And yet, as they go, so crumbles the grassland ecosystem, because prairie dogs are one of the basic pillars that hold that grassland ecosystem together. And yet, somehow, we can't get that across to people.
There is a kind of mentality of monoculture versus the mentality of ecosystems and biodiversity. And it's hard, I mean, in a world where people plant rows and rows and rows and rows of corn or of almond trees or whatever it is they're planting, and then the soil gets so terribly depleted and sometimes needs many years in order to regenerate and a lot of work to regenerate. In the same way, many Americans haven't gotten it through their head that these are complex ecosystems and they can't function as monocultures.
Exactly. And we see this, as you mentioned, time and time again, that monoculture depletes the soil resources, depletes the resources of the ecosystem, disrupts the biodiversity of the ecosystem, and then we're left with dust bowl conditions if the climate changes. And we're left with ecological disasters. And yet, people have such a short-sighted view of things that what makes us money today, what makes us money tomorrow, is good, but what in the long run is best for the ecosystem and for the planet Earth, and in the long run for humans, is bad.
Now, the economics of nature is something that you devote a chapter to in your book, Prairie Dogs. And we have talked on this program before about the idea of ecosystem services. One example that everybody can understand being a watershed. You have nature that filters your water, which is much cheaper and easier than trying to build machines to do it. And now that we are capable of destroying ecosystems that aren't necessarily any more over the next hill, we've really had to find new ways of thinking about nature, ecosystem services. Can you put a dollar value on prairie dogs?
Well, actually, we have tried to do that. I don't remember the exact numbers that we have in that chapter on the economics of prairie dogs. But basically what we show is that the dollar value contribution in terms of ecosystem services that prairie dogs contribute through various factors, water percolation, through various factors of maintaining biodiversity, that those dollar figures greatly exceed the perceived benefits of eradicating prairie dogs, and also greatly exceeds the amount of money spent on eradication programs, on poisoning prairie dogs. Because state governments and federal governments and county governments spend a lot of money, and it's usually taxpayer money often, on eradication programs. And yet even in terms of, if you just look in terms of what the payoff is to ranchers, you can't recoup that money in terms of the payoff to ranchers in terms of, even if you assume that prairie dogs eat a lot of grass, you still can't recoup that money. And when you add in the ecosystem services in there, it's just completely off the map in terms of what prairie dogs contribute economically to the ecosystem and to humanity as a whole, compared to if the prairie dogs were eliminated. One of the reasons that we included that chapter in there is that often when people consider conservation biology, they don't think about it in terms of dollars. They don't think about it in terms of economics. They think about it in terms of aesthetics, that wouldn't it be nice to have these species with us, and we really need to have biodiversity. But for people who think in terms of dollars, often the aesthetic argument really carries very little weight. They can't see the aesthetic value of having a wolf that you can watch. They can't appreciate the aesthetic value of looking at grizzlies. But if you put it in terms of dollars, perhaps, and our hope was, that they can then appreciate the economic value of prairie dogs and other species. You can apply the same argument to many other species that are vanishing as well, and that perhaps this could be a compelling argument for people who don't really appreciate the aesthetic value of some of these species.
Now, the threats to survival on prairie dogs are poisoning, habitat loss, of which there's a huge amount that is devoted to human habitation and agriculture, shooting, there are people who shoot them for sport, and disease. Those seem to be the real threats to their survival. Which are, at this point, the worst and the ones that you focus on when looking at at prairie dog conservation?
They all actually contribute to the disappearance of prairie dogs, and in different regions, they contribute in different ways. For example, in the Flagstaff area, where I've been studying prairie dogs, disease has been the rampant factor that has contributed to prairie dog decline. One of the students at Northern Arizona University for his PhD dissertation looked at how many colonies of prairie dogs in the Flagstaff area were around now compared to 15 years ago. And he found that 85% of the colonies that were around 15 years ago have disappeared, just gone. And that's primarily because of plague, which is an introduced disease that prairie dogs are incredibly susceptible to. Plague was introduced into the United States in about 1900 in San Francisco and has been spreading east, and it's somewhere east of the Mississippi right now. But lots of animals catch plague or are susceptible to plague. Cats, for example, are susceptible to plague. But other animals, like dogs, are not so susceptible to plague, and so they become carriers of the disease. And when a flea, say, bites a coyote that might have been exposed to plague and then jumps off and bites a prairie dog and introduces plague into the prairie dog, then that disease spreads like wildfire through the prairie dog colony, and 98% to 100% of all the prairie dogs in the colony die out. So that colony winks out of existence.
And it's they're so susceptible to it that they're not even in danger, as you write, of affecting humans, because they're not around to spread it. It kills them right away.
Right, it kills them right away. And so if, say, an entire colony is affected and it's in a semi-urban area, it's very easy to see that plague has gotten into that area. And at that point, various public health agencies can dust for fleas around the burrows. They can post signs. They can ask people to keep their pets out. And the plague epidemic or zoo epidemic is contained within that colony, and it doesn't spread to humans. And in fact, plague just generally doesn't spread to humans. The statistics are that roughly in about the last 50 years in Arizona and New Mexico combined, about 30 people have come down with plague. And when you consider that roughly about 30,000 people a year die of traffic accidents in the United States, it would make, you would think, much more sense for us to worry about driving our cars than it is to worry about prairie dogs and plague. And yet people seem to get very perturbed about the possibility of plague, even though the chance of anybody coming down with plague is about the same as somebody getting hit by lightning.
Well, I mean, I think part of what people who are concerned about prairie dogs conservation are up against is a mentality. I mean, I've heard otherwise perfectly wonderful, reasonable people call them vermin with this look of disgust in their eyes. And I mean, it's a cultural, long-standing, long-ingrained idea that all rodents are pests. And that's as much as anything else what you, whoever needs to get over.
Absolutely. It's something that's transmitted from grandpa to grandson, from grandpa to granddaughter. It's transmitted by parents to their kids. As you say, it's a cultural phenomenon that just simply keeps getting transmitted. And unfortunately, it's something that is very difficult to root out. Here's another cultural myth about prairie dogs, that prairie dog burrows routinely break the legs of cows and horses. And so you can't have any cows and horses around prairie dogs because almost instantly the horses would fall into prairie dog burrows and break their legs. Well, I have tried to follow up on this many, many times. When people would tell me this, I'd say, do you know anybody whose horse or cow actually fell into a prairie dog burrow and broke their leg? And usually the answer is, well, no, I don't, but my neighbor has a brother whose cousin had a horse who fell in and had to be put down. And it gets to the point where, for example, one time I was at a colony in Arizona, and I asked this question of a rancher, and he said, well, no, not my horses, but my neighbor had two horses that had to be put down because they broke their legs. And I thought, great, I finally found a really good case where horses have actually fallen in and broken their legs. So I went to this other rancher, and I said, I understand that you had two horses that fell in and broke their legs. And he said, well, it wasn't me, it was my neighbor. And he pointed back to the first person that I talked to.
Oh, my goodness.
So it goes round and round.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Well, what about in cities? I mean, I don't know that having prairie dogs in public parks does anything one way or another toward, large-scale prairie dog conservation. But are there disadvantages to having them in cities? In other words, in the park where they used to be across the street from my house for decades?
Well, the wildlife managers will tell you that the disadvantage is that the prairie dogs get to be inbred, and so there isn't a proper flow of genes from one population to another. But while this may be true in the long run, I really see no disadvantage for either the existing prairie dogs or for the people there, because the people can sit there and watch the prairie dogs. And prairie dogs are incredibly entertaining because they're one of the few mammals that are out in the daytime. Most of our mammals are nocturnal, so we don't see them. Prairie dogs are out in the daytime, and they're always running around. They're scampering. They're fighting with each other. They're playing. They're doing all kinds of things. And it's incredibly entertaining for people, particularly in urban areas where they're aren't a lot of things about nature that you can just simply sit and watch. So I think that there really is no downside to it.
Well, and as you also point out, and this is a kind of larger point, is that many urban people suffer psychologically from disconnection from nature.
Absolutely. As we build up more and more, we build parking lots, we build all kinds of structures, and nature disappears so that people living in cities never really have a chance to experience very much of nature. And if you have local parks where you have prairie dogs, you also have a little bit of their ecosystem. You have plants, you have butterflies, you have various insects coming in, you have lizards, you have snakes, And that's just a little piece of nature that people can experience. And studies have shown that people become psychologically deprived when they're living outside of nature. They aren't as happy as if they're living with a little piece of nature. And so we can improve people's happiness by having them experience nature in parks where there are prairie dogs, where there are other animals, where there are other plants that they can then experience to improve their mood, improve their psychological happiness.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I don't know why they removed the prairie dogs from the park near where I live, but I'm heartbroken. I loved those animals and watched them every day. But
yeah,
anyway.
Usually it's because of a fear of plague. And as I mentioned, the chance of somebody coming down with plague is about the same as the chance of getting struck by lightning.
Now, what are the most effective ways of protecting these animals from extinction? Because, as you said, they're down to somewhere between 1% and 2% of the numbers that they've been at for centuries here in the West. What is the conservation movement all about right now?
I think that Wild Earth Guardians, for example, has a very good strategy, which is that they are suing various government entities that are refusing to list prairie dogs as endangered species or refusing to consider petitions for listing prairie dogs. That, I think, is a very good and very viable strategy. The other strategy that I think is very good is just educating people. For example, BBC did a film based on my work, a one-hour documentary, that they filmed in northern New Mexico around Raton, and it was shown in February across all of Europe. Now, this film is going to be shown by Animal Planet at some point in the United States. And I think if we can have things like this out for the general public to see so that they can see that these animals are really cute. They're just like meerkats. They're the ecological equivalent of meerkats, except that meerkats are carnivorous and these are herbivorous. People love meerkats. Why don't they love prairie dogs? Because they don't know anything about them. So if we can have educational programs about prairie dogs and just educate people about the value of these animals, I think that we can make some headway against this cultural prejudice.
You wrote this book. It's called Prairie Dogs, Communication and Community in an Animal Society. For whom was the book intended?
The book was actually intended for a broad reach of people. We wrote it so that it's readable for the general public. So you don't really need to know a lot of science to pick up the book and read it. But it also has a lot of information in it that is very specific that could be used for land management purposes by land managers, by biologists in parks and preserves. It also has very specific information that can be used for scientists who are studying both prairie dogs and for conservation biologists who are looking for ways to cast their conservation biology studies in broader terms. So I think it has very broad interest for everybody. It's not a very specific scientific book the way that many are about species. We've tried to make it as broad as possible so that everybody can enjoy it.
Well, I found it very readable, and I get very frustrated when there's books that are supposedly for the layman but end up having so much scientific jargon that you can't understand them. This in contrast, was very readable, so I want to thank you very much.
Thank you. We tried to stay away from jargon as much as we could.
Kon Slobochikov is professor of biology at Northern Arizona University. He's co-author of the book Prairie Dogs, Communication and Community in an Animal Society. And he will be here in Santa Fe, New Mexico this Sunday, the 10th of October at 5 o'clock at the Inn and Spa at Loretto. It's part of the Meet the Author series sponsored by Garcia Street Books. We look forward to having you here in Santa Fe. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. I look forward to coming.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You could subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.